and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. On this episode, we're going to be discussing Annabelle Comes Home, which is the umpteenth edition.
Approximately.
To the James Wan expanded universe, to the Conjuring universe.
Yep.
And thanks to this movie, they've seeded like 6 more fucking spinoffs, probably.
Yeah, it's a real throw shit at the wall and see what sticks kind of approach. And a lot of these monsters are just not ready for prime time. It's like how you like throw spaghetti at the wall to see if it's
done.
It's like these are just dry spaghetti noodles.
Nothing
just bouncing off the wall and landing on the floor. Oh, it's not good.
Yeah. No, it's a step above the last entry, The Curse of La Llorona, which our dedicated listener probably
you know who you are.
Remembers. But that's not saying a whole hell of a lot. So without any further ado, Matt, how about you take it away with the synopsis?
So we pick up, correct me if I'm wrong, right after the prologue from the original Conjuring movie. Yes, it's like when the Warrens acquire the Annabelle doll.
I think so.
Ed and Lorraine Warren, Ghostbusters extraordinaire, and they drive away, and they've got Annabelle just kind of perched in the back seat. You might have at least put her in the trunk or something.
Yeah, why wouldn't you put her in the trunk?
Well, maybe they want to keep an eye on her in the rear view. I mean, that stands to reason, so she can't get up to any antics. But they're awfully cavalier about her, it seems to me, knowing what they know about her. Because the movie opens with an exposition dump that I think is lifted directly from the original Conjuring about how, oh, you thought it was a haunted doll, but it's actually a demonic possession. Two totally different things, by the way. It's just pretending to be haunted. It's like
a
demon.
Wait, no, it's not possessed. It's a conduit.
Oh, good God.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Some nonsense.
Right. It's like a demon pretending to be a ghost to make itself more palatable, or I don't know. So they are diverted from their intended course by a car accident, and they take some back road and the car breaks down in front of a cemetery. Lorraine Warren, played by, help me out here,
Vera Farmiga,
can see dead people, you know, basically Sixth Sense style. And so idling in front of a cemetery at night for who knows how long is probably not advisable for her. The car is assailed by any number of ghosts. And
Ed is punted in front of an oncoming semi by a ghost.
Lorraine deduces that the doll, the Annabelle doll, is some kind of spirit magnet. What does she actually say? I wrote it down. It's a beacon for other spirits. And it lingers on that line for a really long time. And I thought that's when we were going to get the title drop. But no, it then cuts to this kind of protracted suspense-free sequence of some random priest throwing holy water at the doll. Is he from another Conjuring movie?
He looks familiar. He's probably in one of the other ones.
Yeah. He looks kind of like the bastard son of Jason Robards and Mitch McConnell. I feel like I couldn't put my finger on it,
oh,
but
I think that's who he... I think he had a recurring role on The Walking Dead. That's where I recognize him from. Yeah. So he might not actually be in a Conjuring movie.
Whatever, just rope The Walking Dead and all of its tertiary franchises into this mess. Why not? The more the merrier, apparently. So this priest, who is unnamed as far as I know, just throws some holy water at Annabelle, and then they decide that they need additional barriers to keep the doll at bay. So Ed's like, oh, what about that chapel glass that we just have lying around? And so they kind of MacGyver this little case for her to stay in, and they hang a warning on it. And
the case looks ready-made to me. It's like they knew they were going to have to put something in it, so they took the chapel glass and fashioned a case out of it.
Yeah, maybe the director's cut is going to have a whole like montage of them assembling it and sanding it down and what have you. But then we get our title drop. There's a kind of would-be retro crawl beforehand, kind of Texas Chainsaw Massacre style, being, you know, the following events are such and such, and then Annabelle comes home.
Yeah, and I guess the reason why they wait for the title drop to come there is because Annabelle is coming to their home.
Right.
Which is crap, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah, let's not mince words. We're then introduced to Ed and Lorraine's daughter, Judy, who kind of looks like the second coming of Mara Wilson. Got like a little bit of a Matilda vibe from her with that haircut.
Yeah, a little bit.
And she can also see ghouls. ghosts and what have you, ghosts and goblins. This is established when she's at school. She sees the specter of some long dead priest who maybe founded the school. There's a bust of him in the hallway, and he's kind of menacing her. We're also introduced to Judy's babysitter, who I believe is named Mary, and her friend Daniela. The two of them engage in some pretty cringy, like, teen banter in a supermarket. Mary is buying supplies for Judy's birthday party. The Warrens are going away for the weekend or something, and it's just going to be the two of them, or the three of them, as it turns out, because Daniela kind of invites herself over. And the grocer at the market is this awkward dweeb that Mary is crushing on, and his name is Bob. And the only reason this sequence is worth recounting is because of the tomato sauce lady.
So this is completely irrelevant, but yes, apparently it's Bob's dad's grocery store, because his dad comes over and like tells him, yeah, there's looks like a crime scene over in aisle 5. We have a smashed jar of tomato sauce. Can you go over and clean that up? And he's like, yeah, Dad, I got it. You know, leave me alone while I'm talking to these girls.
Get off my back, Dad.
So he finishes ringing them up and sending them on their way. And then the aforementioned Mrs. Whatever just shows up looking impossibly somber. And just covered in tomato sauce.
She looks like Kevin Spacey in Seven. Like, what, detective?
And she just says, there was an accident.
It's
so
good.
To give Gary Dauberman, creator, at least in the writing side of the Conjuring franchise, and director of this film, I think that was meant to be played for laughs.
I think so too,
but it almost overshoots. It's too silly.
It's extremely silly, and it was either always meant to be a gag or it was at one point meant to have a scare cord underneath it. And it's impossible to say which just by virtue of the kind of movie that this is.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. Tomato Sauce Lady needs her own spinoff ASAP. Rush two sequels into development before the first one is even out. It's a guaranteed smash. It's going to smash the box office like she smashed that jar of tomato sauce.
On accident?
Yes, exactly. All of this is just one big accident. So as I mentioned, Daniela invites herself over to the Warrens' house after they skip town. As you would imagine, they have some pretty strict rules about what you are and are not allowed to go snooping around in, since they have a shitload of haunted relics in a locked room. And Daniela is just like drawn to it like a moth to a flame.
And at first it seems like the only motivation she's going to have been given
is to be a fucking nuisance.
Is to be just a pain in the ass teenager doing teenagery things. But
because every line she has in the first 20 minutes of the movie is just dripping with mischief. She's constantly like, oh, but you know, we could get away with such and such, you know, that kind of thing. So it seems she is set up to be extremely one note that way. Very irritating. Her kind of bull in a china shop routine runs through this whole movie. She's always tampering with shit that would be better left alone.
Yeah, so she is left alone in the house to watch the cake that's in the oven while Mary and Judy go off to cruise around the block in Judy's new roller skates, which Daniela gave her. They were hand-me-downs.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, as we know she is going to do, she makes a beeline for the relic room. Can't get in because it's hella locked. Snoops around, finds the keys, goes in there and just starts, you know, poking around and touching everything.
Just getting the lay of the land, you know.
And again, this is where the one small mercy comes in, where
right.
She's given an actual motivation for doing this, which is that her father is recently deceased. She blames herself. We find out later, but I might as well tell you now.
Please.
There was a car accident. She was driving. He died. Obviously, she's fine, at least physically. So she's in there to try and make contact with her dead father, and doesn't really work out.
No, because all of the monsters in this big sprawling franchise are the same, and they basically all, I mean, you know, superficially, they're distinct, but fundamentally, they all kind of are just trickster shapeshifters.
Yeah.
And they all appear to get off on impersonating loved ones in order to make you try to forge some kind of connection with them. That's how they get their kicks, apparently. That's what sustains them. So she thinks that she's making contact with her father, and we can't stress this strongly enough. She touches fucking everything in that room. It takes a really long time for her to manhandle just like the haunted piano and the haunted cymbal monkey and the haunted television and on and on and on.
Finally, she gets to the case of chapel glass.
Yes.
Where Annabelle's locked up.
And beautiful craftsmanship, especially knowing how quickly they threw it together.
There's a sign that says, positively do not open.
Yeah.
And, of course, that is the first thing she does.
You'd think they could have slapped a little more fine print on there, you know, like, warning, positively do not open. Also, this doll will pretend to be haunted by someone you care about, but is in fact a soul-devouring demon. You know, just like a little bit of, I don't know. I mean, it's not for their benefit, obviously, because they know the score, but just in case they get any interlopers. That would be enough to dissuade me, you know, even if I had indirectly contributed to my father's untimely passing.
Yeah, so she opens up the case.
Kind of, but then she closes it again. But she leaves it unlocked, crucially, I think, right?
And then...
Annabelle head desks her way out of the cage. That's the only way I can describe it. It's just like a thud, like against the glass. And then she's just kind of stuck there for a moment, inert.
And then she falls out of the case.
Because this doll is extremely inanimate. Like, by the standards of haunted doll movies, and I know she's not actually haunted, the movie has been very clear on that point. By the standard of doll movies of this ilk, she's extremely wooden. She's not capable of perambulation, as far as we know.
Yeah.
She just kind of sits there and gawks at you. That yields diminishing returns in this particular movie, and also in this, I guess, trilogy.
Yeah, so meanwhile, and this is what gets Daniela not to, like, actually take out the doll. A smoke alarm goes off.
Oh, yeah, because the cake is burning.
It's
a very you-had-one-job kind of moment.
Yeah. And so, okay, they have a burnt cake, whatever. They get over it.
Yeah, there'll be other birthdays.
Right.
Grow up. So, subsequently, Daniela and Judy, is that the little girl's name?
Yes.
Are having a little bit of a heart-to-heart out in the backyard, and Judy levels with her about the I see dead people thing. I think that's that this happens now, and Daniela opens up more about her dad, calls him Darling Dad. Apparently that was they had a pet name for one another, Darling Dad, Darling Daniela, you get the idea. And then she sees her father just kind of like futzing about in the kitchen of the house, and she runs inside to investigate.
He's not really doing anything. He's just like standing on the other side of the sliding glass door, just looking at her. And then he kind of wanders off, because that's what spirits do when they're far away and they're trying to lure you.
Right. Like a fucking angler fish. Yeah. So then my notes are kind of scattered at this point, because the movie is very scattered. As I said, it's undercooked spaghetti noodle approach to screenwriting. Judy is attacked by a homicidal bride.
Because this is one of the many artifacts highlighted in the relic room.
Yeah.
There's a dress. There's a wedding dress. Which, by the way, is perfectly spotless white. And yet, like, all of the accompanying photos in their case file have it covered in blood. So did they take it to the cleaners? Like,
yeah, I mean, maybe the idea there is that the dress is like nourishing itself somehow, or like repairing itself,
who
that it's
knows?
Like sentient. But like, but none of the movie, none of the monsters in this movie get that kind of attention. There's not that much room for lore for each of them because there's so fucking many. There's like, it's standing room only in this fucking movie with its boogeymen.
Yeah, and this is the beginning of a really big middle section of the film where most of the time each of Judy, Mary, and Daniela, and also Bob the dweeb from the grocery store, all have like their own stuff going on where they're alone and grappling with some demon or other.
Yeah, minutes and minutes pass in this movie without any meaningful dialogue. I mean, any interplay between two or more characters. Like I want to say like 75% of this movie is just characters individually fumbling around in the dark, encountering monster pulled out of a hat.
Yeah.
Me even just saying those words made me imagine like a monster that literally pulls itself out of a hat. Like, feel like that could be its own Conjuring spinoff. Some, you know, like a haunted top hat or something with it. I don't know. That's fucking it's all very R.L. Stein. It's all extremely Goosebumps.
Yeah. I guess just to explain how Bob gets brought back into this whole thing, Daniela, when they're at the grocery store, informs him that Mary is babysitting at the Warrens. Oh, I live across the street from the Warrens. Daniela's like, I know. Basically, that's why I told you.
Oh, yeah, right.
So he comes over just to say hi and then leaves. And then a couple scenes later, he comes back and is like serenading Mary with a guitar badly. But of course, she finds it incredibly charming. And yet, by the time they get down to the door to go talk to him, he is chased off, no shit, by a fucking werewolf.
By a fog beast. By a snarling fog beast. It's a malevolent mist that occasionally coheres into, yeah, just a straight-up werewolf.
That they call the Black Shuck.
What?
Yeah.
I didn't catch that.
It's from a case file.
Yeah. Okay, right, because they've gone through a bunch of case files at this point. There's this awful sequence where they're just poking around in, like, these manila folders, being like, oh, Judy, what's this one? Oh, what's this one? What's his deal? How's this one work?
Judy, like, becomes Mrs. Exposition Dump.
It's so thankless, and it lasts such a long time. They literally just do three or four of them in a row, because
they have to set up the sequence we're talking about now.
Chop, chop, people. Time is money. We got, like, four monsters to roll off this assembly line.
Yeah, so Bob has to grapple with the Black Shuck fucking werewolf thing for his thread of the film.
Yeah.
And yeah, meanwhile, Judy's getting chased both by this bride thing for a while and also by Annabelle. There's a little girl associated with Annabelle that is sometimes a little girl and sometimes full grown and sometimes a demon.
Get
more into that in a minute.
Every monster in this franchise, meaning the whole Conjuring franchise, can be anything it wants to be. They're all just shapeshifters, like I said. And that, it's this. I've complained about this before. I think it was in our review of The Nun. These movies just run through my fingers like sand for that reason, because it's just all so arbitrary. None of them makes much of an impression.
So it's around this time that Daniela gets packed off. Go home. I'm putting Judy to bed, sort of thing.
Right.
Daniela gets like five steps out the door, realizes she still has the keys, so she has to sneak back in through the back door, which through some like dad baiting results in her going
gross
back.
Don't ever say dad baiting again. That sounds like an especially gross variation of catfishing.
Oh god, no. Why?
I don't know.
She is lured by what appears to be her father. That's what I meant.
Yeah, okay. Please carry on.
Into the relic room, where she gets locked in, of course. And
dad baiting. Just imagine like a pop-up thumbnail that's like, these hot dads want to, in your area.
Please, let's not belabor
okay,
this point.
You don't have to beg me. I'll stop.
So
just this once.
So that's where Daniela spends the next chunk of the movie. Mary puts Judy to bed. Judy has to deal with Annabelle being just in her bed, and then the little girl version of Annabelle who turns into other stuff also. And then Mary, while she's alone, she's like doing homework, I think, or something.
Something.
And watching TV, even though she didn't turn on the TV and doesn't really think that's super weird.
Right.
Here's some stuff coming from the other room. I guess the projector or like a reel-to-reel tape recorder started playing. It's some recording of a little kid talking to Ed about the ferryman.
More exposition, basically.
So
the first two or three times they said ferryman, I heard ferryman.
Right.
Like he was good, like the tooth fairy, or
right.
like Glinda the Good Witch or something.
But,
you know, like,
but
I was
no,
imagining
it's like Charon.
Yeah, I was imagining
the ferryman of the River Styx.
Right. I was imagining a very different shtick. Let's put it that way. But yeah, no, it's coins on the eyes to get them downriver into the underworld.
Yeah, so she starts seeing corpses with coins over their eyes, and eventually, after a lot of false starts, coins floating in the air and then falling to the ground when she puts a flashlight on it and stuff, she meets the ferryman who, I could not stress enough how irritating this is to me, just as a principle of monster design, but why the fuck does the ferryman have coins over his own eyes?
He's a professional, Jim.
The coins are for him to be paid. He does not have to pay himself in coins his own eyes.
That's why every time you pass a toll on the highway, you fork over, you know, some pocket change, and then the guy in the booth is also like, oh, fuck, hang on.
Fishes some money out of his
reaches into
pants.
His pockets. It's stupid.
So, yeah, Mary's dealing with the ferryman, and it looks like she's going to get dragged off somewhere. The flashlight goes out, and then it comes back on, and she gets away. She runs off to go check on Judy. Judy's bedroom door is locked. She's banging on the door trying to get in, and of course, inside the room, nothing can be heard, because why not?
Why not?
So Judy's got Annabelle in bed with her. She's getting, like, sucked under the covers.
Yeah, she's getting Ju-on'd. It's, like, right out of The Grudge. Like,
yeah.
The scary ghost girl under the blankets. That's, you know, it's beat for beat. Just that famous spook from The Grudge.
Yeah.
Either version of The Grudge.
Yeah. And Judy successfully hurls the doll out of her bed, knocking this kind of weird,
like colored,
rotating nightlight,
like
thing.
Colored oscilloscope kind of thing.
Yeah, it's got like four different colored panels that rotate over the light, so it throws different colored lights. So we watch Annabelle through this thing as it rotates. At first, it's just the doll.
This is when you see Annabelle's Pokemon evolution. She switches from a Charmander to a Charmeleon to a Charizard before our very eyes.
So first, it's just the doll, and then it's the doll with the shadow of the little girl, who, by the way, there's a scene, it's in the trailer, this doesn't really matter, but I'll throw it in anyway. This girl, like, rings the bell a bunch and knocks on the door. Mary answers it earlier during the day, and she asks for Annabelle. Of course, oh, I think you have the wrong house.
Yeah.
No, I don't. She's in there. Whatever.
I complained about that particular beat when we were reviewing Brightburn, I think, because I was talking about how sullen-looking kids are never scary. They just look like they're throwing a tantrum.
And show enough, once again.
Not scary.
Anyway, so that girl's silhouette is the second form. And then there's like just a taller, ganglier, ricketier looking woman with a knife, I think. And then it's just a demon.
Yeah.
It's just a straight demon with horns that looks like Tim Curry in Legend, kind of.
Oh, spectacular. Yeah, no, and then we got a better look at it in the flesh, so to speak, and it looks like a goat man made out of beef jerky. It's like, it's just pure Beelzebub, pure, I don't know, any cloven-hoofed devil kind of figure you can possibly imagine.
Yeah, so Judy wriggles free and successfully gets out of her room, finds Mary waiting there for her. So they get downstairs, and they attempt to call the Warrens.
Mm-hmm.
For help. And
kind of a phone a friend situation.
Right. Lorraine answers the phone. They're trying to explain the situation. And Lorraine asked to speak to Annabelle.
Uh-huh.
So it's obvious immediately that this is a possessed phone call.
Right.
And it ends pretty much how you'd think, with quote-unquote Lorraine just mm-hmm. screaming she wants a soul.
Then who that was
she
phone?
Being Annabelle. Yeah. So then there's a scene of Daniela still in the goddamn relic room. She's just given up, I think. She's
yeah,
like,
she's erected a rickety lean-to. She's like, she's
conserving her resources.
Yeah, she's filtering her pee through a makeshift filtration system.
So there's a scene we skipped over because I was trying to do these all of a piece, but there's a scene where after she's gone back in the second time, where she manages finally to summon her father, and the jump scare in that is that she turns to face him and his face is all fucked up, as in, you know, after a car accident, and he's just screaming, you did this to me! Mm-hmm. Rah!
Yeah.
It's like, okay, fine.
That
sure.
exact cadence.
Yeah, almost exactly, yes. So that's happened to her, and now she's just kind of fetal positioning it next to a rack of spooky relics, and this old-fashioned phone is ringing. Now, this is set up by the haunted TV, which in an earlier scene we
oh,
see
yeah.
it's like slightly ahead.
Only very slightly, though. It's like reality is lagging only very slightly behind.
Well, it's
the
very
TV.
Slight the first time, but then in this scene, we see this phone ringing in the TV screen, Daniela going over to it, and then, like, there's static, and then her face is just covered in blood.
Yeah, which never ends up happening. Which, again, this could be, I can hypothesize, oh, maybe the TV predicts the future accurately enough times to, like, win your confidence, and then it starts showing you things that only might happen to, like, fuck with your head. That could be fun if the haunted TV was in this movie for more than 80 seconds.
Also, it's not like she's watching the TV
right.
at this point.
It's strictly
so
for the audience's benefit.
Yeah, so she is not at all, she has no opportunity to be scared by her own blood-covered visage.
Right, I guess the TV is just trying to keep itself busy.
And it's trying to, like, oh, we're going to see this happen to Daniela pretty soon. Except, again, somehow the lag time has vastly increased. And phone starts ringing, and she starts coming over to it. But she's saved, thankfully, by Mary and Judy rushing in and stopping her. Excuse me. Judy stops her because Judy knows everything.
Yes.
This was established in the look through the files exposition dump scene, and it's reinforced with every scene that comes after it. Judy just knows everything that her parents know, basically. It's like, why are they even calling her parents at that point?
Yeah, right.
She tells Daniela not to pick up the phone.
Literally the only haunted object that she has not interacted with, apparently. It's like, oh no, don't do that. Then we'd really be in trouble. We'd have 31 demons harassing us instead of just a mere 30.
So everything in the room starts rattling then for some reason?
Right, it's weird. This moment is also in the trailer. They're like, Daniela, how many things did you touch? Or, you know, tell me everything that you touched. And Daniela goes, I touched everything, and then right on cue,
everything
goes off. And it's weird how long it takes that cat to come out of the bag, because we are very close to the end of the movie at this point, and they have been assailed by demons for upwards of half an hour at this point. Time kind of becomes highly relative,
yeah,
because there's like a hugely overlong second act, basically. A big kind of middle stretch, as my co-host described it earlier. Yeah, so it's hard to say exactly, but it is weird that Daniela being the catalyst for all this is not established earlier. I mean, for the other characters, because there's just so much buck wild nonsense going on. That revelation is very belated, I think.
So they get out of the room. Mary starts having an asthma attack. It's established earlier she has asthma. This doesn't just come entirely out of left field.
It basically comes out of left field. There's one shot in the grocery store where she gets nervous and takes a puff of off her inhaler before she goes to talk to the nerdy grocer boy.
Yeah.
And that's it, as far as I remember.
Well, anyway, so she needs her inhaler, which she left in the car. So Judy's going to go out and get it because Judy's a badass, I guess. And Daniela gets lured off for some reason, and
Take your pick.
She gets...
Pick a monster, any monster.
She gets possessed or not possessed.
Oh, that was so dumb. Yeah.
She gets possessed by the bride, the bloody bride.
Yeah, the bride stabs her in the gut, in the stomach.
It's like a sequence in a movie, maybe a heist movie or something, where they're like... The protagonists are planning out what they're gonna do
with a dummy knife.
Like,
you
rewinds,
mean? Yeah, right.
And then does something different.
Yeah, the movie just says JK lol. It's weird. It's like a nightmare scene without the rigmarole of like the character waking up covered in sweat and panting. Like it just happens and then it undoes itself. It's the damnedest thing. She gets stabbed in the gut and then she's fine.
And then she's fallen down on the ground, and then she, like, sits up, and then the bride is just in her face, and then it just vomits black ichor, because that's the lifeblood of this franchise.
Yes. I think, if you cut James Wan, it would come out black and oily.
just vomits a torrent of this stuff directly into Daniela's mouth, which I guess is how possession transmission works.
Who knows? It's a very kind of drag me to hell sort of shot.
Yeah,
which it's kind of a strange outlier in this movie for that reason. I just didn't know what I was looking at after a certain point.
So Bob is out in the chicken coop because the Warrens have chickens and they have a coop, and he's hiding from the goddamn werewolf.
Yes.
The black shuck.
The fog beast.
Which I will never stop saying. And one of the chickens gets out and he's like, "No, don't go."
it's like the moment in the movie when like the love interest heroically sacrifices themselves, but it's just him and a chicken he's just met. "No, please. Oh god, I'm sorry." And he like closes the door behind it. And again, as with the tomato sauce lady, this is probably funny on purpose, but it does make everything around it feel that much more farcical by association.
So while the chicken is getting squawk murdered, he manages to get out and he runs off. Now Judy is outside. She gets into the car. She gets the inhaler. But then the black shuck has her cornered in the car, bashes a couple of the windows, gets on top of the roof, which is actually a rag top, apparently, starts slashing through it. She manages to get out, and Bob comes to the rescue, smashes the black shuck with his guitar, and it turns it into fog.
Yeah, it does the trick, apparently.
While still breaking the guitar. Yeah.
Silver Bullets and Wonderwall. Those are a werewolf's two great weaknesses, as we all know.
And do you remember what happens to Bob after this happens?
We don't see him again. I think he just... No, I don't remember what happens. The movie keeps forgetting about Bob, and therefore I keep forgetting about Bob. He spends the whole back half of this movie running around outside. That'd probably be its own movie at this point. They'll just use B-roll that didn't make it into Annabelle Comes Home. We'll call it like Annabelle Comes Home Again.
So I don't know what happens to Bob. Neither of us does. But Judy gets back inside.
That's between him and the wolf man.
The black shuck. And Judy brings Mary her inhaler. And so Mary's fine. Cool. Daniela, as we said, has wandered off by this point. And so they go looking for her. And she calls to them from upstairs. Something like, "Guys, I'm up here," you know, sounding very innocent and kind of scared.
Oh, yeah, Judy, and then Judy's just like, "Nah, she's possessed."
Judy knows immediately. Because, once again, Judy knows everything.
Like, right. And so nothing comes of it, of Daniela's possession. They immediately catch on to the ruse, and it was such a weird little dead end.
Something does happen.
Does it? Okay, well.
We'll get to it.
The whole second half of this movie is just a bunch of kind of false starts and blind alleys and unfulfilled potential.
So Judy tells Mary that they have to find Annabelle. They have to find the doll and put it back in the case. That's the only way to fix all of this. So unfortunately, they don't know where Annabelle is. So they go doll hunting. They get back to the study. Annabelle is hiding in this closet, and then the door closes again before they can get over to it. They have to fish the key out of this feely meely game.
Right. Oh, this is another boogeyman that we haven't touched on.
Basically, it's a game where there's a couple of holes in a box, and you have to feel your way through and try to find a particular object. So they have to find the key, but they... Meanwhile, I'm leaning over to Matt saying, just rip the box open. Like, it's cardboard. What are you doing?
Right.
But they also just cut off the scare before they even allow it to happen by Judy just fishes it out immediately while Mary's trying to be more deliberate.
Right, yeah. Subverting expectations? Maybe. You whatever. Decide.
So they get the key. They open the closet. Mary has to go in there. She has more fucking... ferryman shenanigans.
Yeah, some more shit goes bump in the night. You
she
know the drill.
Comes face to face with her own corpse with coins over its eyes, holding Annabelle. She tugs on Annabelle. The only payoff there is that the corpse screams at her. Ooh.
Very loud. Very sudden.
And then we're back with Judy outside, who's been kneeling, praying this whole time.
Yeah.
Annabelle gets tossed outside, and Mary's like, run.
Yeah,
and this is when we get the payoff for Daniela. Daniela, who is now wearing the possessed dress somehow. Yeah.
My eyes were so glazed over at this point. I probably just didn't. I don't think. I actually, this is not performative. I did not recognize her. I just thought it was the bride again. Because also, most of this movie plays out in like near total darkness. That's the other thing.
Yeah. So Daniela shows up and she's got a knife and she's trying to stab.
But we've already seen this knife stab someone and do nothing. So we're, the stakes have...
Only Daniela, though. But now that it is... whatever. Doesn't matter.
Yes, indeed.
Mary gets out of the closet in time to wrestle with Daniela, because it wouldn't be a fucking James Wan movie without some demon wrestling. They fight her to a standstill. They manage to get her in front of a projector screen, at which time they turn on this projector that's got spooled up home video of Ed conducting an exorcism. We see this clip earlier on during the file reading scene.
Mm-hmm.
They play it again, and basically this is how they get the Warrens to do their job without them even being in this part of the movie. Because it's just a sequence where he's doing the fucking incantation, like, hearken to me, oh demon, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And it works on the possessed Daniela.
Yeah, the demon is defeated by a recording
of Ed Warren.
Of an exorcism, of Patrick Wilson just chanting, the power of Christ compels you, that whole thing. And it's weird. It has troubling theological implications, I think. You wonder if, like, the demon could have also been slain by a photocopier or something, or like some other
picture of a cross, you know?
Or yeah, like a picture of a movie of a cross. It's like how many degrees of separation before it stops being holy. I don't know.
Yeah, and
very
then
silly.
Daniela for this stretch is just stuck in front of the screen, kind of smoking, getting exorcised. Mary and Judy run back to the relic room. They've got Annabelle. They're trying to get her in the case. The demon, in full Tim Curry and Legend mode,
yes,
pounces on Judy, smacks Mary out of the way, starts, trying to suck Judy's soul out of her face.
Yeah, he's just hoovering her soul, like, right out of her face. That's exactly what it looks like. It's very like Brendan Fraser mummy.
Oh, God, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But like, dopier,
you know,
looking.
You know what it is?
Nah.
It's like Dementors.
Yeah,
Harry Potter, it's Dementor face sucking. It looks almost exactly like that.
Yeah, it's goofy as hell, whatever it is.
Yeah. I got to take a break.
No, I know. I said my eyes were glazing over earlier. My whole brain has a glaze on it at this point, like a fucking donut. Like, have I made that joke before?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, I just got powerful deja vu. Anyway, carry on.
So Judy manages to get this cross off of the shelf behind her and presses it down on the demon's face, which, predictable results. He smokes and kind of rushes off. Yeah.
Because every monster in this franchise is no match for God. Like, well, yeah. Like, if you've got God in your corner, then of course you're gonna, you know, like, it. That's it. The game over.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And they get Annabelle in the case, but they can't get it closed. Daniela, back to her normal self, normal garb, shows up and helps them get the case closed. They turn the key. It's locked. And Judy says the evil is contained, just as her mother did, word for word, after they finished putting Annabelle away in the prologue.
Oh, yeah, that was a little echo. I didn't catch that.
Yeah.
Again, brain glaze.
Yeah, and then after that, it's pretty much just a happy ending.
Yeah, they all have happy endings.
Bob has resurfaced, asks if they're okay. They say yes. They all spend the night in the living room.
Yeah. He asks the babysitter to homecoming. She says yes.
And then Judy has her birthday. At first, it's just her parents. I was left wondering, well, like, where's Daniela and Mary, at least? It doesn't make any sense that they're not here. Sure enough, they show up.
Along with a whole slew of randos, including one character who we have met, who is Daniela's younger brother, who has been bullying Judy, but now he's trying to bury the hatchet, and it's just terribly after school special.
It's so saccharine.
Yeah.
Just about made me want to vomit. And that's it. It zooms in on a family photo, which gets replaced by a family photo of the actual Warrens, because I always forget that.
Oh yeah.
These were real people that James Wan has fucking hijacked into his franchise. And yeah, in memory of Lorraine Warren, because I guess she died this year at the age of 90-something. So, you know, rip, I suppose.
Yeah, she was killed in a freak, snarling fog beast accident.
The Black Shuck.
That's right, I was trying to fucking remember.
And after a very belabored synopsis, we have finally reached the end. So we're going to go ahead and take our break, and we'll be back in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do?
I let her out.
Who? Annabelle.
I'm sorry.
What else did you touch?
Everything.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/shockdoctorspod, or check us out on iTunes. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
I sometimes see things. Like how my mom sees things.
The doll, it's a beacon for other spirits.
Back. Now, after that incredibly long synopsis riddled with a lot of commentary, you might think we don't have anything more to say about this movie, but you would be sorely mistaken.
Yeah, you would be just stone cold wrong. So there is an old Family Guy gag where it's Stephen King talking to his agent or his publisher or something, and he's clearly brainstorming on the fly the idea for his next book. And he says, it's about a family living in Maine who gets attacked by an evil lamp. And he grabs a lamp off the desk and starts shaking it at the guy. It's a very, like, Anchorman kind of, like, just looking around the room. You know, Stephen King, are you just looking around the room and saying that things are scary? But that feels like a pretty close approximation of what the writer's room must have been like on this movie. They are just... it's so haphazard. You know, like,
so we touched on most of them.
Mm-hmm.
There's Annabelle, obviously. And I think the thing here is that Gary Dauberman and his team realized that Annabelle, particularly after having already done two whole movies just for Annabelle.
Yeah. And having peaked in the first scene of the first Conjuring movie in 2013. It's the last time I remember her being especially scary.
Annabelle herself cannot carry the movie,
mm-hmm.
cannot scare sufficiently. So there's just a rogues gallery of other beasts and demons. We have the werewolf, the Black Shuck, and we have the bride, the dress. We have the ferryman wearing coins on his own goddamn eyes. Fuck. And then there's the one that we missed during the synopsis.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, so many of these scenes are fucking disposable.
Yeah.
There is also a suit of samurai armor.
Yep.
It's in the trailer.
It sure is.
There's a shot in the trailer, which I was expecting to show up in the first scene of Daniela being in the relic room.
Yeah, that's how it's cut. It's integrated into the trailer that way.
Yeah, it doesn't show up until the second one, so I thought it was just something that got left in the cutting room floor.
Where it belongs, frankly. I was like, oh yeah, we lost Samurai Guy. That's okay. But no, we did not lose Samurai Guy. There is a lot of Samurai Guy in this movie.
So yeah, there's a shot in the trailer of her walking past him and his head just turning.
Yeah, it's very,
when I say head, I really mean empty helmet.
Yeah, it's exactly like that joke in Beauty and the Beast where Cogsworth is going, if it's not broke, don't fix it, and like all the like suits of armor turn to look at him.
So there's a couple of scenes where the armor just shows up or turns or moves that are kind of nondescript, but the samurai armor has its day in the sun.
Oh, yes.
Or rather, in the pitch darkness. Because there's a sequence where it's just in the hallway.
This is so good.
While Judy and Mary are trying to find Annabelle. And from far away, we just hear like...
Yeah.
Just very quietly. And I'm like, are they... are they really gonna do this?
They're doing an audio flashback in Japanese about the samurai armor's like dark origin story. I don't know, because I don't.
It's just like a samurai or a samurai demon murdering a bunch of Japanese people.
Yeah, you hear a woman screaming
and a lot of shouting in Japanese.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's really all that happens. Mary gets kind of put into a trance by it for a second. And then Judy's like, hurry up, come on, let's go.
I'll say this for the samurai guy. At least it is one monster in this franchise that is guaranteed to not dish out any lame smack talk. At least not in the language that I can understand. There's not going to be any, the village is missing its idiot. Kind of want to blow your brains out.
Wasn't the nun fucking Romanian? Like,
that's true.
That didn't stop anything. I swear to God, when we get in 2024, the fucking samurai armor spinoff Conjuring movie, it's gonna spend the first 90% of the film just being, oh, and then all of a sudden it's just going to speak English while it's being wrestled during the climax.
Yes, yeah.
So just put it in the book. Like, mark it down. I'm saying it now.
Smart money's on. Samurai Guy 2024.
God damn it. But we are 1,000% going to have a Ferryman spinoff. I know this, one, just because I know how this shit works now, and two, because I'm pretty sure I actually read that somewhere. The Ferryman is going to be the next spinoff.
Yeah, but like, they were hyping Crooked Man as far back as Conjuring 2, and nothing ever came of that.
Yeah.
Because they're all just making this shit up as they go.
I would not put Crooked Man to bed yet.
I know, I agree. I just kind of figured he'd show up in this movie since it's such a grab bag. I feel sorry for if there are any Crooked Man stands out there really chomping at the bit to see more of that guy, because he's really been left on the sidelines. They still got him benched. Put me in, coach. I'm ready.
The Black Shuck will probably get its own spinoff.
Oh, God. The introductory shot of the snarling fog beast is prodigiously stupid looking. It's just like this mist, this misty, wispy form is kind of assembling itself out on the lawn. And again, this is a tonal whiplash, because Bob, the dweeb, has just been serenading his crush under the window with his acoustic guitar. And then in the blink of an eye, an awful looking CGI werewolf face lunges directly at the camera.
And then the shot... This might just be headcanon at this point. I might be remembering it how I want to remember.
See,
it.
Now I just imagined a boogeyman named Headcanon, who has a cannon for a head. These movies are a disease. I can't turn it off now. Is this how it happened to James Wan? Did he like touch a haunted artifact in a curio shop? No, he just can't turn it off.
So, again, I may have imagined this, But I swear to God, the reverse shot of the snarling werewolf face is Bob running away, and it's the camera work is like some Evil Dead shit. It's like it's like demon cam, like jerking back and forth.
Yeah, it's a werewolf's eye view.
And
it's like those shots in Alien 3 of like the alien chasing people.
Yes. So yeah, any one of those three, we just rattled off three, right? I can't remember.
Who the fuck knows anymore?
So the ferryman, the samurai, and the black shuck could all easily be spin-offs and probably will be. The only one that I think we're safe from is the bride, simply because it would play
so fucking redundant after
between the nun and La Llorona.
Yeah, not to mention The Bride. I think it might have been called The Black Bride. It might have just been called The Bride.
Oh, in Insidious?
The antagonist from Insidious 2, who is also a kind of peripheral character in the first one. Yeah, they really are repeating themselves very badly with that one. And this movie already has too many monsters. So why they would double down on one, I have no idea. Again, the Insidious movies are not connected lore-wise to the Conjuring movies, because they also
Patrick
have...
Patrick Wilson is in both
Patrick,
of them.
Yeah, right, exactly.
As not Ed Warren, so...
They could do some soap opera bullshit where he's his own long-lost twin. I don't know.
Well, yeah, but Conjuring movies are period pieces, so Patrick Wilson would have to be, like, Ed Warren's, like, bastard son.
Right. Although in the Insidious movies, they spend so much time spelunking around in the Upside Down, or whatever they call it, and there is a time travel element to that, if memory serves.
You're right.
At least in the very first one. So nothing is off limits. That's what we've been saying over and over again. The rules are made up on the fly, and they do not matter.
We said this in our second episode,
yeah,
because that's the one about the nun.
Yes.
God, it's every demon that you can shoehorn into a hour and 45 minute movie, they did.
And they're overcompensating for Annabelle's lack of presence and personality. Like I said, she's totally inert, immobile. She just sits there.
Yeah, this is not a Chucky doll.
No. In fact, I complained in our review of the new Child's Play that Chucky doesn't have enough personality. Compared to Annabelle, new Chucky is like Dennis Hopper in Blue Velvet. Just exploding with personality. Just like bursting at the seams with it. It's like, God, Annabelle is boring. Like, the doll is imposing looking, and it worked in the first scene of the first Conjuring movie, which is basically a self-contained short film. The kind of clickbaity 10 short films that'll keep you up at night, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
That if you're a weirdo like me, you keep finding in your like YouTube recommendations. And you know, and can be fertile soil sometimes. I mean, there was a Lights Out feature, you know, there was a Mama movie that started out as a short, but like most of the boogeymen in this movie in particular, and in this whole series, belong in short films. That's just what they're suited to, I think. Like they just have not been thought out very thoroughly. They have a gimmick and it's pretty simple. That's it.
Well, yeah, and it's almost like, and I say this knowing full well that I just said that most of these will get their own spin-offs, but that doesn't make what I'm about to say any less true. It's it's like, in addition to Annabelle not being able to carry a third movie on her own, the writers knew that none of these secondary demons could
dry spaghetti noodles
could carry that role in the film on their own either. That's why there's so many of them. Like if it was just Annabelle and the ferryman, or if it was if it was just Annabelle and the black shuck, Annabelle and the fucking bride.
Well, if you recall, that's how they used to do it. That's how Crooked Man came to be. He was like the one other like new monster that they trotted out in Conjuring 2, and he felt super phoned in and out of place. But now they're just, it's like they're firing monsters out of a fucking t-shirt cannon. Just saying like, what about this one? What about this one? It just reeks of desperation.
Yeah.
And I was struck by kind of a weird thought. Well, two kind of weird thoughts, and I'll deal with them in the order in which they occurred to me. The first was that this movie and this premise, this setting, And these monsters and their gimmicks and their appearances and their designs and their methodologies, their MOs, could be fun and freaky in a survival horror video game where you're creeping around this big haunted house trying to evade different flavors of things that are going to chase after you and scream at you real good. Like an SCP kind of thing or a fucking Outlast. I don't know. But like they almost feel designed more for that kind of hands-on user experience rather than a movie that you're just supposed to sit back and watch because, I don't know, I was just massively checked out for more than half of this movie after it settles into its routine and the characters all get split up and separated like it's Scooby-Doo.
Yeah.
And the second weird thought that I had, and I kind of alluded to this earlier when I said that the whole movie felt very R.L. Stein, which I think is doing a minor disservice to R.L. Stein because at least he knew what he was doing. In terms of, like, he knew his audience, basically. He knew that he was doing PG, if not G-rated horror for kids. Whereas this, I don't know what the rating is. They don't cuss a whole lot in this movie. It seems like they're trying to get kids' asses in seats, same as anybody. But it's a purportedly mature horror movie for all ages, adults included. But the whole thing just feels, more than Goosebumps, it feels profoundly Jumanjian. Like, just, like, very, 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 very Jumanjian. And I think it's because of how overcrowded the movie is. It's like, it just felt like Jumanji after a certain point. There's a rhino, there's a pelican, there's a tiger, there's a whole fucking safari, a whole fucking zoo's worth.
In defense of that point, we had also neglected to mention that at one point the Feely Mealy box has hands sprouting out of it that try and do grab Judy for a hot second.
Honestly, Jumanji, the Robin Williams one, is just like a baker's dozen jump scares shy of being a branded Conjuring movie. Like, it's about a haunted object that wreaks havoc in the lives of ordinary suburban people. That's what I'm saying. It was just like a little bit of coaxing. Damn near anything could be a Conjuring movie. There's no, it's like herding cats. I said that in the Nun review ages and ages ago. I stand by it. I've never felt more vindicated on this fucking show. I have a hot take.
Cool.
I don't know if I actually liked Feely Mealy or if I just really wanted to like Feely Mealy. I think it's mismanaged because they introduce it too late or its screen time is weirdly distributed where by the time it kind of actually starts doing anything sinister, it's way too late for them to be sitting around playing board games. Like, the shit has officially hit the fan well and truly by that point. So I feel like it should have, the Feely Mealy stuff should have peaked earlier and maybe been the first indication that things were going off the rails.
Yeah.
That I would have liked. I like its box art. It's kind of got like a 60s Milton Bradley vibe to it, but there are these
I think it's actually a Milton Bradley game. I saw the MB like in the lower right.
But with these sort of ominous grasping hands on the it's good stuff, or could have been, rather.
Yeah, they seed the ground for Feely Mealy at the appropriate time. It's early on before any real creepy shit starts happening. Judy and Mary and Daniela are playing this game and rooting around for whatever in the box. And then that's the last time we see Feely Mealy until they have to get the key out of the box.
Right.
And then at that point, it would just be like way too far of a step down.
Yeah, right.
In terms of tension, unless I suppose the box eats somebody's arm a la that sculpture in Velvet Buzzsaw.
Yeah, right. Or if it like sprouted 8 spider legs and started scuttling after them. Because again, any of these monsters can do anything they want.
But even so, it could have done something and it didn't because they also cut it off before it did anything. Because Mary's very carefully reaching her hand towards the hole to get the key out. And then in one of the other holes, Judy just plunges it in and has the key immediately.
Yeah, you can imagine whatever demon is lurking inside the Feely Mealy box. Damn
it.
Being like, oh, not fair.
You cheated.
You're not following the rules. Read the instruction manual.
And that's it. That's it for Feely Mealy, other than the dumb, like, oh, it's got hands grabbing you,
yeah,
whatever. Like, that's so far down the totem pole of shit they have to care about, mm-hmm, by the time it happens.
Yeah.
I agree completely. Feely Mealy was, I don't know that I would have loved it, but it was definitely done dirty in terms of its placement.
Yeah, it missed its window, for sure. Which is a shame, because I feel like it could be a real cultural phenomenon if they just gave it room to breathe. Like, I want the next generation, like whatever comes after Gen Z, instead of saying feels, to say Feely Mealies. Like, like, ow, right in the Feely Mealies. last note on Feely Mealy, and I concede this is a dumb thing to be impressed by. So it's a box with four holes cut into it. I think at least two holes cut into the side of it for people to reach into. Like the kind of DIY Halloween attraction where it's like, oh, this is a plate full of brains, you know, that kind of thing where you don't see what you're touching.
A bowl full of eyes.
Yeah, right, yeah, exactly. And despite them, again, this is relatively early on in the movie because the fucking lights are still on. Despite them playing Feely Mealy in a well-lit room in the middle of the day, all of the holes are like supernaturally dark. They're just these inky voids. And it looks kind of dumb and unconvincing, but in a way that I'm a little bit into. And none of them comment on it, the characters, I mean, which makes it a little more endearing because it's kind of the only time that this movie gives its audience that kind of respect. Like, you're just supposed to catch on that it looks off. Or maybe it was just an effect that was kind of shoddy and poorly implemented. I don't know, but it's a little bit low-key uncanny in a way that I was kind of into, whether or not it was deliberate. And I'm officially done singing Feely Mealy's praises, which means that I'm done singing this movie's praises in all likelihood.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm sitting on any other positive notes. I mean, the performances are all fine. They usually are.
Yeah. I guess I know this movie is not called The Conjuring whatever number.
Oh, yeah, they're, like, barely in it.
But,
is that,
yeah, I was expecting more of the Warrens. And clearly, I think the writers understood that at least a little bit because they had to bring Ed back in recorded form to do the heavy exorcism lifting. And, you know, I'm not saying the appearance of Ed and Lorraine Warren produces a great horror movie. The first Conjuring's pretty good.
Yeah.
The second one's kind of weak,
not as good, yeah.
But Patrick Wilson, Vera Farmiga are enjoyable to watch, and if you're gonna have this big confrontation, why not have an honest exorcism instead of this pre-recorded projector bullshit?
Seriously. And you know, now that you mention it, it's possible that having more of them in the movie would have solved this problem, but the little dash of Ed and Lorraine that we do get in this movie, I feel like it was exactly the wrong amount, at least for me, because for the first time ever, I found them kind of incredibly irritating. And maybe I would feel the same way if I went back and rewatched the first two Conjurings, but they're just, were they always this Cleaver-esque, like Leave It to Beaver, like this wholesome?
I don't think so.
And, yeah, because it's really bad this time around, and it's kind of endemic to their characters and the ethos of this whole franchise, which is that the demon is always vanquished by the power of love and faith and familial bonds, but especially faith. And it's like, they're just like at the end of the movie at the little girl's birthday party, Patrick Wilson is like, who wants a song? And he picks up a guitar and he's such a fucking youth pastor. You know, it's like, well, I can't.
And it's funny too, because there's a scene in Conjuring 2 where he breaks out a guitar and just starts singing a tune.
It's Can't Help Falling in Love, and then the movie ends on that note too, with them dancing to it, the Elvis Presley song. Yeah, so these movies have always gotten soft and sappy right at the very end, but never more so than here, I'd say, with the fucking bully getting a redemption arc of all the damn things.
Well, and not just a redemption arc, but he shows up, he's like wearing a little fucking suit and he's all smiley, and it's almost like, well, actually, he had a fucking crush on Judy the whole time. Oh, and now yeah, they're going to be like preteen boyfriend and girlfriend.
Odious. Yeah, you're right. Because that's how middle school boys show attraction, you know, by giving you swirlies or whatever.
I thought the conventional wisdom was that girls did that.
I could be wrong. It's horseshit either
sure.
way.
Yeah, right.
But
exactly.
Yeah, no. No, yeah. Ed and Lorraine kind of annoyed me this time around because they were just way too Bible-y. In a way that I don't think they have been before, but it might just be their characterization might be more thin than usual because everything in this movie is just a little bit more thin and threadbare than usual. I'm gonna rattle off a bunch of really minor gripes, which is that one, in the first part of this movie, there's way too many ghost wipes. I think, you know what I mean? Like where there'll be a ghost in the background and someone or something will move in front of it and then it'll be gone. Yeah. One or two of those is fine, but like it's kind of this movie's only trick for about half an hour right at the very beginning. And that got old real fast.
And that's something that is endemic to the James Wan expanded universe.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the only positive thing I can say about it is I find that less irritating than the naked misdirection of where demon is going to charge from.
Yeah.
So it's not as bad as that, but it's not good.
Maybe just because it's not as overplayed, although it's pretty fucking driven into the ground at this point. Both of those tricks are real stale. Because I was a pedant about... I think the one nice thing that I said about The Prodigy several episodes ago was that I liked the font of the title. I mean, there may or may not have been an opening crawl in that movie. I don't remember. This time around, I did not care for the font. So just for the sake of consistency, I'm not trying to make that my brand, but it just didn't do anything for me. And I said, again, in the Prodigy review, my favorite part of the first Conjuring movie is the Texas Chainsaw Massacre style opening crawl with the yellow text with the music under it saying like the following events are based on real events and the events happened to real people in reality, that kind of thing. This time around, the crawl was pretty inept. I thought like I just looked at it and thought, nah.
Nah,
not feeling it. I'm just not feeling it.
Nah,
this time,
bro.
And that kind of, got things off on the wrong foot. There's a lot of talk in all of these movies, the Ed and Lorraine-centric movies in particular, where there's a lot of stipulating about, oh, it's not a poltergeist, it's a ghost. Oh, it's not a haunting, it's a possession. Oh, that object isn't haunted, it's cursed.
It's a conduit.
Yeah, and these are all discrete categories of supernatural fuckery.
And why?
Who cares? And it's a problem for me, and I don't really want to harp on about this, because the lady did just shuffle off her mortal coil and go to the Upside Down, or whatever it's called in the Insidious movies. But in reality, Ed and Lorraine Warren are charlatans, and the movie calls attention to this in a scene that I would have preferred not been there for that reason, where Patrick Wilson picks up a newspaper with a headline that says Ed and Lorraine Warren, heroes or hoaxes or something like that. I think heroes or hoax.
Yeah.
I think is what it says. And so the movie is calling attention to this idea that like, oh, people think that we're a bunch of grifters, and obviously we're not meant to think that, but I feel like it's a mistake to even bring it up.
Yeah.
Because I'm usually the asshole skeptic atheist in the room. I try not to be too much of a dickhead about it. But like when they start harping on about, oh, it's not a curse, it's a haunting. Oh, it's not a haunting, it's a who gives a shit. It's all such fucking snake oil. You know, like I just don't. It's like
if we pile on more detail, it sounds more technical and believable.
It sounds more credible. Yeah, right, exactly. Like this InfoWars supplement is going to give you more testosterone, and this one is going to add inches to your cock. You know, it's like, at one point, the little girl, Mara Wilson 2.0, is explaining how, my mother collects bells. Those aren't spirit bells, but this one is a spirit bell. It lets you know when ghosts are nearby. And I'm thinking, like, surely any of them could let you know a ghost is nearby if the ghost was rambunctious enough, which is what ends up happening.
Yes.
So there's no point differentiating between a normal bell and a spirit bell. It's like, who are you trying to fool?
Although, to give the movie credit real quick, that moment where all the bells are going off was the one time in this whole movie where I got a little bit of a... Ugh.
Right.
It did get me a little bit.
Yeah, because there is a little bit of planting and payoff there. I get that. Yeah, no, I mean, credit where it's due. But,
and only there.
Yeah, and nowhere
just
else.
Just there.
Yeah. So, yeah, I have my beef with that aspect of the movie, the kind of slimy, huckstery kind of aspect of the Warren's persona. But, you know, again, RIP.
Yeah.
I think I'm finally done. I feel like Daniel Day-Lewis in There Will Be Blood. I'm finished.
Yeah.
Actually, I have one more stupid diatribe, which you are welcome to cut out. This is mostly just for our benefit. Do you remember when we saw Curse of La Llorona and the guy, the cop, I think he was, brought home
a
prop pizza that looked incredibly unappetizing?
It's the second James Wan universe movie in a row. I thought this too during the movie, where there is a prop pizza that looks fucking inedible.
It looks atrocious. And so I guess that's just what pizza is in the Conjuring universe, which makes it hell, by the way. Like, the devil has already won. God's creation is fucking forfeit at that point, if that's what pizza is.
It's either that, or James Wan just believes that pizza in the 70s was dog shit.
Yeah, because, like, I started laughing in the theater as soon as she pulled the, like, raised the slice to her mouth, because I was remembering us riffing on the La Llorona movie, and none of this made it into the episode, by the way. We were going, like, the guy brings in the prop pizza, and he's like, oh, shit, sorry, these aren't pepperonis. I accidentally got condoms dipped in red house paint. My bad. Oh, shit, that's not cheese. That's ground-up saran wrap. So that's a kind of funny recurring motif. I hope that they stick to that. I hope that every James Wan pizza delivery is even less appetizing than the one that preceded it.
On that note.
Yeah, I guess that's the note we want to end on. Actually, it isn't. I have a parting word, which is that the opening shot and the very first line of this movie, it's a tight close-up on Annabelle's staring porcelain eye, and Patrick Wilson says, and I quote, "It was a big mistake acknowledging this doll." We're the shock doctors.
Ain't that the fucking truth? I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the shock doctors. We will see you next time.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Annabelle Comes Home official trailer uploaded by Warner Brothers Pictures. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, July 28th, and we'll be discussing Ari Aster's new film, Midsommar. See you then.